case for this morning, United States v. Wilson. Mr. Falvey?
Thank you. May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. I would like to address two issues with the Court this morning. First of all, whether defendant appellant Wilson is entitled to a remand of his ineffective assistance of counsel claim for further fact-finding at the district court. And second, whether the Booker error was properly preserved below such that he's entitled to a full resentencing rather than a limited Palladino remand.
I wanted to talk to you about your proposal that there be a remand for factual development of the ineffective assistance of counsel case, because that's a procedure that this circuit, at least, has not embraced, as far as I can tell so far. I haven't seen any case in which we actually did that. And I have the following two problems with it. One of them is that the normal course of a direct appeal involves only things that are in the record before the district court, and you're essentially saying that the district courts almost have an obligation to have an additional phase of the original proceedings in which performance of counsel is investigated, which would be quite an innovation, I think, for federal practice. Secondly, to be honest, it strikes me as a backdoor way to get two 2255s, because if you got your remand now and got ineffective counsel investigated, then he presumably could come along later and raise a 2255 with other issues. I don't mean with that particular issue, but still in all, under the normal way of proceeding, you'd have to fold all of your 2255 issues into one appeal.
So maybe you could. Particular case, I'll start with your last comment and work backwards. With 2255, in this particular case, it will not be available to this particular defendant. He is a permanent resident, green card holder, and is such subject to removal proceedings on the basis of the conviction. So that relief, avenue of relief, will not be available to him. At the moment, the department, DHS, INS, have stayed the proceedings based on the outcome of his direct appeal. However, after this proceeding is over, they will once again initiate those proceedings such that he will, in all likelihood, not be able to take advantage of 2255.
Because he'd fail the in-custody requirement?
No.
I can see how he would still be benefited by setting aside the conviction, even on 2255, but if he fails the custody requirement, then perhaps...
No, my understanding is he would still be in custody because he has 3 years of supervised release. However, they will immediately initiate those proceedings. He would likely be removed. I'm not an immigration lawyer, but I understand within 3 to 12 months is a typical time frame, and it is likely that by the time he's removed, the habeas proceeding would not have been come to fruition, such that there's some case law, in particular a Judge Posner opinion, which escapes me at the moment, which says that it would be mooted if he is actually already removed because the relief he seeks is has already been mooted, effectively.
Well, it would depend on what relief he was seeking. It seems to me if it's relief focusing on the sentence, that will may be correct. If it's relief that goes to the heart of the conviction, then at some future point were he to apply to the Attorney General for readmission, I'm not sure. But anyway, I accept the thought that one would want to look into whether relief would be mooted.
And also, if I could, then to get to your broader question of whether this is an appropriate and efficient procedure, I think it's a limited procedure for certain cases. And in the D.C. Circuit and both the First Circuit have embraced it. The D.C. Circuit in both the Rashad and Fennell cases have said that it is their generalized procedure to remand ineffective assistance of counsel claims on direct appeal, unless it is absolutely clear in the record that there was or was not ineffective assistance. The First Circuit uses, I think, a slightly more limited test by referring to or looking at indicia of evidence of ineffectiveness. I think there's even some more recent case law where they look at a plus factor, something unique.
But how do you respond to the problem? That implies still to me that the district court did something wrong by not creating an ancillary proceeding on effectiveness of counsel at the trial level. We don't normally remand unless the district court has made a misstep.
That's correct. In these cases, the First Circuit, I think it was, addressed this issue and specifically said it wouldn't expect the trial counsel to make his own motion for ineffectiveness. And as such, when new counsel is appointed on appeal, that gives the court an opportunity to review the record such that it can remand, despite the fact that the district court did or didn't do something inappropriate. In this case, we are not alleging that the district court did anything inappropriate. We're alleging that counsel was ineffective by way of his opening and opening statement and closing argument, in where he concedes defendant's guilt without any evidence in the record that defendant conceded to that admission. And that is somewhat on all fours with the U.S. v. Holman case, where, and if you will indulge me for a second, Judge Williams, I'll quote her opinion, stated, "An attorney's concession of a client's guilt without any indication of the client's consent to the strategy is deficient conduct for Strickland purposes." We believe we have that here. And we believe that there are additional things in this case such that a remand is appropriate that can be examined. For example, there were no, other than a pretrial sentencing memorandum and a pretrial motion to encourage Judge Guzman to accept the plea of Mr. Wilson, there were no pretrial motions. There could have been, we believe, certain pretrial motions actually going to the guilt and innocence of Defendant Wilson. For example, there's no evidence that we were able to find in the record that he was ever Mirandized after he was arrested. That maybe he was, maybe he wasn't, but it was something that could have been explored by counsel. There's also a great deal of evidence relating to his cooperation. Judge Guzman stated after opening statements that he believed that wasn't relevant in the least and shouldn't come in. Nonetheless, defense counsel kept bringing it up. It had nothing to do with defendant's guilt or innocence, but he kept bringing up cooperation. And, you know, of course, if you're sitting on a jury and you're hearing that the defendant's cooperating, what are you going to think? Especially after the fact that defendant has given an opening where he says he fessed up to everything.
There's nothing that would have prevented new counsel from filing a 2255 motion right away, right?
Well, I'm not entirely sure about that. I think my understanding is you have to exhaust your remedies on direct appeal before you can go back to 2255.
2254 is different, but 2255...
Right. And furthermore, with respect to our issue with the Department of Homeland Security, once we dismiss the appeal, the direct appeal, and if we were to go right to 2255, they would initiate their proceedings. I see that I'm already at my time rebuttal, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Falvey. Mr. Kramer?
Thank you. Good morning. I will start with the remand on the sentencing first before I get to the ineffective assistance. It's the government's position that defense counsel did not preserve that at the May hearing. The May hearing, the only argument was the amount of loss. Government argued it was approximately $300,000. Defense counsel was arguing it was approximately $40,000. It was not a Sixth Amendment argument. It was an argument based upon the testimony and what level of increase it was going to be, whether it was going to result in a level 13 or a level 14. The difference would have been approximately 3 months at the high end of the level 13 for the sentence, which the defendant has already served.
So this is just your argument that it's just a Palladino remand, not
That is correct, Judge. Okay. That is correct. It is not until December 14th, after the sentencing, 7 months after the sentencing, where defense counsel was arguing that Mr. Wilson should be maintain his release status pending an appeal, that the Sixth Amendment argument was raised. And I'll rest on my the briefs with respect to that issue. With respect to the ineffective assistance argument, this could have been raised at a 2255 months ago. This trial actually was years ago that the defendant was convicted. There is no indicia that the decision would have been different regardless of counsel's actions. This was an extremely strong case for the government. There were two cooperators who testified. There was testimony and indeed video of the defendant cooperating. There was physical evidence. There were several searches. There were several other statements given by the defendant before and during his cooperation. It wouldn't really matter who the defense counsel was, nor the tact that was taken at trial. I would note, counsel just argued, based upon defense counsel's opening and closing, that in and of itself shows an indicia of ineffective assistance. Defense counsel here had a difficult road to hoe. One reasonable argument would have been, and indeed taken, that defendant was cooperating. However, it was a buyer-seller relationship, which defense counsel argued, I believe, over my objection for the instruction to be given. Judge Guzman gave that instruction, and defense counsel argued a buyer-seller relationship, which was reasonable given the facts. The jury still convicted, obviously, but that was a reasonable tact for defense counsel to have taken at the time. The openings and closings aside, defense counsel did vigorous cross-examinations of the government's witnesses, both cooperators, the agents, as well as other witnesses that testified regarding physical evidence that was seized and statements that were taken from the defendant. Defense counsel did not merely just sit there and watch this play out.
No, he apparently made it clear that the fellow was prepared to plead guilty. You're saying that didn't matter because the evidence was so strong.
One, I think a reasonable tact for defense counsel to take, he couldn't deny that Mr. Wilson cooperated with the government. There was video of that. There was tape of that. That argument...
Maybe he couldn't deny it, but he's propounding that theory, isn't he?
I think one reasonable tact a trial lawyer can take is to confess what he knows is going to come out after the first witness starts speaking, and then change the argument, which he did, into a buyer-seller relationship. In other words, if I were arguing, yes, George Wilson was doing these certain acts with respect to the credit cards and the trip to Vietnam. However, it was a buyer-seller relationship. That's reasonable given the facts that he knew was going to come out 20 minutes after he stopped talking in opening. If he did the opposite, if he said that George Wilson did not cooperate, that at no time did he make any statements, that is very difficult for a trial lawyer to recover from.
But he doesn't have to say that. I mean, to say he did cooperate, the set of choices are to address the cooperation, to deny the cooperation, or to say nothing about the cooperation. And I guess even if he couldn't have denied it, maybe holding back until these government witnesses speak might have been better. It seems to me, though, in a broader sense, so your argument has to be, let's assume there was ineffective performance. That's only one half of the Strickland test. Anyway, I understand the government's argument to be, even if the performance was completely ridiculous, the evidence was so strong that you wouldn't show prejudice, which is the usual kind of thing we would see at the 2255 stage.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, which is why I bring up all the evidence that the government had, the two cooperators, the tape, the video, the searches, the computer that was recovered with the 315 credit card numbers on it, which is why I say this was an extremely strong case for the government that went in as smoothly as it possibly could
have
been.
Mr. Kramer, maybe you stated this, but what's the government's position on us addressing the ineffective assistance of counsel at this stage?
Judge, there is no reason why we should create a separate category, which is what counsel seems to be arguing, for defendants who are convicted but are resident aliens and subject to another penalty. A 2255 could have been submitted. Counsel's argument basically seems to be, since we're going back on a Palladino remand anyways, let's have a hearing on ineffective assistance. This circuit has not adopted that approach, and this is certainly not the case for it. We should not create a separate category of criminal defendants who get a remand for ineffective assistance because they are subject to deportation or another sanction. And again, if the court was going to consider that in the future, I would submit that this is certainly not the test case for it.
Well, the preferred procedure is to have a hearing outside of the record, and you're just saying that's for some reason you don't have that in this case. I'm not sure I understand why.
I think there could have been that procedure if a 2255 was filed initially, which I would submit there was time to do. It was not necessary to take the direct appeal first and then argue at that direct appeal time, now, for a remand, essentially, on a 2255 issue. I don't think counsel has, in either his brief or his reply brief, attacked that or argued why that was the approach, why it could not have been taken before. And again, this is not the test case that the circuit should change prior history. And with that, Your Honors, I would suggest a limited Palladino remand for the sentencing issue, but you should deny a remand based upon ineffective assistance to hold further hearings on what clearly seems to be a fishing expedition. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Feldman.
Thank you. I'll just quickly comment on the sentencing issue. We'll stand pretty much on our briefs, but we believe that the second hearing did in fact preserve the Booker error such that a full resentencing is appropriate as opposed to the limited Palladino remand. With that, I will quickly turn to the prejudice question that you are raising, Judge Wood. The Harris decision at page 558 specifically says, I'm paraphrasing, without a more developed record, it is difficult or we can't tell whether prejudice occurred. That is why, one of the reasons why we are requesting a remand at this juncture is for determination of prejudice at the district court level. And I would also quickly comment that I don't believe that this circuit is necessarily changing course by adopting this procedure. In the I'm going to mispronounce this.
Well, your opponent says you don't have to adopt it. You could have brought a 2255. That's
right.
You just said.
That's correct. But the difficulty with that in this case is that our defendant is a resident alien such that he would have been subject to removal proceedings had we gone that route. But the Ostia.
You could have asked for a stay, just as people do typically in appeals.
That's correct. Right.
Anyway.
But quickly, the Ossia-Bonteg and also Harris case hint at the fact that this circuit would consider remand on direct appeal for further fact-finding. Harris invited the appellant to do so, but the appellant didn't do so until late in the game. That was after oral argument and submitted a late submission. The court said, you're too late. We're not going to accept it at this point. The Ossia-Bonteg, and again, I'm probably mispronouncing it, case actually said that was one of the options that this court could consider upon a showing of quote unquote some prejudice. Did not go into great detail as to what some prejudice was, however. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Falvey. And you took this case by appointment, did you?
Yes.
And the court expresses its thanks for your vigorous representation of your client.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel.